My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. Welcome back to the Mysteries and Monsters podcast. On this episode, Adele Casillas-Rocha joins me to discuss her debut book, Portal, A Lifetime of Paranormal Experiences. Adele has been involved in the investigation of unexplained phenomena most of her life, notably in her work as a MUFON investigator. This has allowed her to build up a level of trust with people who may never have come forward with their experiences across a whole gamut of the paranormal. We discuss curses, UFOs and ufology, alien abduction, ghosts, cryptids and more. Don't forget you can follow us on Facebook and YouTube under Mysteries and Monsters, on Instagram as Mysteries Monsters, and plus we're also on Twitter at Mystery Monsters. You can also support us on Patreon to keep the werewolves from the door. And the podcast is now on all platforms, so please rate, share and support us as much as you can. Now, let's get to the interview. So today I'm joined by author Adele Casillas-Rocha to discuss her book, Portal, A Lifetime of Paranormal Experiences. She's been a field investigator for MUFON and now currently resides in Pennsylvania. Adele, welcome and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Paul.
So, how are you today? Everything okay?
Oh, we're good. We just have a little bit of allergies, and the sun is now shining. It was raining all morning, which would have made a good backdrop for the stories I'm about to tell you. But I think we're expecting more gloomy weather later on, so.
Enjoy it while you can, then.
Yes.
Right. So, I mean, obviously, I've read the book. Really, really enjoyed it. And I think what I enjoyed about it the most was the variety of stories and experiences that you cover in the book. But what is it that got you in this position, Adele, that made you want to collect these stories and experiences as your first book?
Well, Paul, it's been a while. I've been collecting a lot of stories through the years. It started with me as a very small child being raised in a neighborhood. And for the listeners who are not familiar with the Philippines, back in the mid-60s, the Philippines was composed of small villages. There was one large town at the time. You know, it was a decent-sized city, but not as busy as it is today. And it was called Manila. And around the area of Manila, there were several small villages, little towns and hamlets. One of them was called San Juan. I spent my childhood there, and the neighborhood I was in happened to be the site of a Japanese massacre. My interest began when I became increasingly aware, as I grew up in the area, of just several stories, and they were not legends. They were actual stories from real people living in the homes that were around me, in particular, a home that was across the street from me. You know, the Philippines was the center, the hotbed of World War II, being that strategically it was centered in the middle. Well, that's redundant. It's in the middle of Asia.
Yes.
Right below China and Japan, and you know, you could see one of its feet actually touches on Indonesia and Thailand to the south. Because of that, it was used as a foothold during World War II.
Yeah.
It's a very tiny country. I'm trying to think of a similarity. I would say it's probably smaller than England, Paul. It's comparatively the same shape, incidentally, but a little bit smaller than England. And it's composed of several thousand islands, of which the head of the country is where the center of the commerce begins. And that's around the city of Manila.
Yeah.
So I grew up in a neighborhood that was haunted simply because it had seen war. And it had seen a lot of violence, which is why I entitled the book Portal, because it seemed like there's a tear in the fabric of reality, and it centers around certain areas where there are Japanese soldiers and Filipino victims that were murdered during the war.
Yeah.
So that's how my interest began.
Right. I mean, it is interesting because I think it's a common theme around the world, Adele. That when you have a tragedy or an occupation or something, things seem to be different after something's occurred of that nature. I'm thinking specifically, I once went to Glencoe in Scotland, which was the scene of a very famous battle over here in the UK. And we went there in the daytime. I was absolutely fine. And at night, it just felt really heavy and oppressive all night.
Malignant.
Yeah, and it was so uncomfortable. We were supposed to stay there two nights, and we had to leave. I couldn't stay another night.
I believe that. I think that, especially with old countries, where I live now, of course, the U.S. is only roughly 200 years old, but it's also seen as civil war. But when you layer on one violent battle after another, and then you get into a large scale of deaths, tragic deaths, sudden and violent deaths, and you know, people being tortured, and you have definitely a feeling of gloom that pervades the area. And I hear you, because though I have not been in Scotland, I've been in England, I've been in Ireland, and I've seen certain areas that during the day seemed very beautiful. But you would not find me there. Maybe with a large group of people, but not, yes. You know, it's just one of those things. You'll feel it.
Very much so, yeah. It seems like history is imprinted in the area regardless of what time people return to it, I think.
Exactly. It's different now, from what I understand, because there's so many people that live there in the area. You know, it's only basically the little countryside area south of that. And I've included a particular area that has a university that is about 3 hours south of Manila. And to this day, the hauntings continue there because it continues to be a small, you know, it's probably about a village of 3,000 people.
Yep.
And it's people are scattered about. It's still very much an agricultural community, and then nestled within the middle of that is a university, which is known for its agricultural college and its veterinary medicine school. But some parts of the book I talk about, I actually visited the area. I was there and I visited some friends. This is probably the last visit, actually, that I made. I stayed there for over a month. And because the Japanese were so pervasive in the Philippines, they infiltrated the university. And what happened in this particular case is they took some priests who were in a neighboring cloister, and they imprisoned them in the basement. With some POWs. And what happened after that is they were tortured. The priests were forced to march on the stage of this, what is now a gymnasium. And you could still see them parading if you happen to be alone, and this is a sizable gym that has a stage on one side, if you happen to be alone walking through the gym in the late of night, and students have told me this, and I'll go from the very beginning. There was a gentleman who was new to the school. He had just started school at the university. I interviewed him. He indicated that he was working out in one of the gym facilities. I think they were using some kind of racquetball or squash court or something like that. And he stayed behind only because he was cleaning his shoes and he had put them on. And it was late. It was probably close to about midnight. And he came out into the main area where the exit was. And he turned around because he felt kind of like a swishing sound, or felt a swishing sound behind him. And he turned around in time to look up on the stage. On the stage, he saw these dark figures. They were wearing monk garbs, priest garbs, and you could see that from the body on down, there were feet and they were marching kind of like in a circle, but they had no heads.
Oof.
So, needless to say, a witness ran rather quickly out of the gym, and he crossed the quadrangle and hastily got into his car. So that's just one of many things that tend to happen there. And then they still have lonely lanes where, things have happened, and they see things. You mentioned something called a capre. That's Kapre, and that's supposed to be like a kind of like a demon, I would imagine, that protects a tree. It is not a pleasant thing to witness. What it is it's a disembodied entity that has very bright red eyes. And they have seen this creature perched on the top of a tree a number of times in the lonely little streets that they have, and it's not well lighted. If you're driving with a car, probably the only light you have is the headlights from your car.
I mean, the Capres are a really interesting. One of the things I really like about the Capre, and I find it, most weird creatures or paranormal entities are often preceded by an aroma, but the Capre apparently has a penchant for cigars or tobacco. Is that right?
Well, it's interesting that you asked me that, because there was a suspicion that in the backyard of this one house in our neighborhood, and there was something that was living in the backyard, and one of the servants went out there one night and she thought she saw something behind a tree. And as she approached, it came down from the tree, and she could not discern in the darkness what it was, but she saw the bright red eyes, and then she smelled what she thought was cigar smoke. It's an interesting thing, because you also, when you think about the devil or the demon, people talk about the scent of not just so much cigar smoke, but a certain aroma of something burning.
Yeah, it's like sulfur, isn't it? It's like sulfur burning.
Sulfur, yes, exactly. And so I kind of wonder, like people would say it's protecting the tree. My theory is that it's a demonic entity. And if I think that if it terrifies you, instead of making you feel kind of like a warm presence, it makes you cold and terrified. I think it definitely is a negative entity.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's one of the strangest little creatures that I've read up on, because purely because, especially that cigar smoke is a very distinct aroma as well.
Yes. There have been sightings, and I will tell you this in the beginning of the book. It begins with, well, I would say probably into the third or fourth chapter. the scene of a tragedy in a little town called Little Baguio. And Little Baguio at the time of this encounter was just a hamlet. There were probably 6 or 7 homes in the area, and they built an apartment complex. And there were what they would call in the U.S. garden style. You know, you have the ground floor and then the first floor. And they were probably attached to each other, much like a farmhouse.
Yeah.
It goes on, and it's rectangular in shape. But a creature there that was seen was more like a Mothman. If you recall the movie of the same name, Mothman Prophecies, this creature, no one really can define it, although the witnesses that I've spoken with believe it is actually a demon and not a Mothman. I think people have mixed feelings about what the nature of the Mothman is, whether it is actually predicting misfortune, as it did in the book by John Keel, in the same movie, or whether it's actually there to wreak havoc on a family. In this particular case that I talk about in the book, I believe it did have some predictive value, but it also intended havoc on the family, because it was very invasive and it led to the man's death.
I mean, well, obviously, as you refer to in the book, the main character at the beginning of the few chapters that we start with is a lady called Lisa, and it does seem that there's something just attached to this family for whatever reason, that there doesn't seem to be any kind of enticement or encouragement for this creature to kind of come along and meddle, as it were, with this family. So I found that really interesting, that this, you know, from her growing up and moving through life, this kind of circle of phenomena seemed to continue with her wherever she was in the world.
You gravitate around her, yes. Yeah. A lot of people have mentioned that to me that have also read the book. One gentleman who read the book earlier on, right after it was published and put on Kindle, indicated that he felt that somehow the family was cursed. And I will tell you, and you will probably remember parts of it that would suggest that possibility. In the opening parts of the book, when the mother, the matriarch, was fleeing with her 4 children, they came upon a convent in the middle of the tropical forest. Back in the, I would say, probably 43, 42, when this was happening, a lot of the Philippines is wooded. So this young woman, who was only in her, I would say, maybe late 20s, early 30s at the time, was fleeing on foot with 4 small children, fleeing for their lives, trying to hide from the Japanese. And her husband was a medical doctor who ended up in a MASH unit. So they were separated. And the gentleman told May, who read the book, that he thought that whatever the young girl encountered, in this case, it was a nun, who hit her on the knee. It was a nun who was not alive, obviously. They came upon this convent, and she was roaming the halls, and we're talking by candlelight. She came upon a room, and in the room there were several beds. It was a convent, but it had been abandoned because they're not sure whether the Japanese had already been there. There were no bodies or anything. It was just simply abandoned, but there was like the detritus of people having lived there and fled. And you can tell it was hastily. She was sleeping, this child, and she was around 6 or 7 at the time. She woke up from a dead sleep in the middle of the night, and she sees this specter approaching her from the other end of the room, and as it was getting closer, she realized it was a figure of a nun, and it was floating. It was a nun in black habit. She could not tell from the darkness the face, And then when it got closer, she could see it was very, very angry. And if you felt anger, you know, real deep anger, rage, this is what she felt. This is what she told me. I actually spoke with her. And the creature came up to her and punched her in the leg and left a mark of a signet ring. And it stayed until she was, after she was married. And then when her husband passed away, sadly, the mark disappeared. So the gentleman who read it said, I think that that was a curse. That was the beginning of all the different tragedies that happened in the house until they moved to that little town, San Juan. And she then was a young lady by then and living under the same roof as the rest of her siblings. They encountered all kinds of entities from the Japanese soldiers who were never really given a decent burial. To entities that were somehow they were demonic.
Yeah, I mean, that's concerning. As I mean, that's not, you know, I wouldn't like to see that as an adult, never mind as a 6 or 7 year old child, with the greatest of respect. It's, you know, what went on in that area of the world, especially during the Second World War. One can only hope those nuns escaped. As much to my shame, I studied the Second World War quite intensively at school and at university, so it's always something that's really interested me. So that fact that it's that this child sees a nun in such a kind of opposite personality to what she would probably expect a nun to be is quite disturbing. That what would have caused that spirit to be in that frame of mind.
And it's interesting. I don't know, to tell you the truth, but the sense that she got was that it sought her out because somehow she was invading its space. And when you think about hauntings in old homes and castles and things of that nature, when something or someone dies tragically, they hold on to whatever property they were in. And they don't want anyone else to be there. And that was the sense. I mean, the girl started screaming. She then knew she wasn't wanted. And she ran off and reunited with her mother that was on the ground floor and the rest of the siblings. And, you know, the next, I don't think they slept for the rest of the evening. And they, obviously they just were using it as a place to kind of rest and try to get some sleep before they kept moving on. But definitely there was a sense of them having entered an area that was already inhabited, so to speak. So, and then there's another point in the book that could be the possibility of why I've always said, you know, you lead a quiet life, and if everybody is happy and content, nothing happens to you. Until one day, violence happens.
Yeah.
Or something, someone has done something to disrupt the normal course of life.
Yeah.
And I will leave you with that thought, because somewhere in the book, you know, the husband, the medical doctor, came home after the war. And what happened when he rejoined the family, the matriarch of the family, his wife, always felt that his personality had changed.
Yeah.
Whether it was because of what he witnessed during the war, or maybe that was latent in him, we will never know. But I think that was the opportunity for the portal to open once again and invite something that was not benevolent.
It would be, I mean, regardless, I mean, curses, like, as you refer to someone, you know, coming to you and saying that that's what their interpretation is. I mean, it goes beyond the realms of coincidence that someone should see and experience as much as this lady does throughout her life, like you say. And I think there's clearly something there. But then you would kind of say, because usually a curse is put on somebody for a specific reason, whether it, you know, you they've been wronged.
Right. Or exactly.
You know, the Bell Witch is a famous one because that was allegedly about property that was stolen from
yes.
someone. And the woman that was robbed basically cursed the family to be
yes.
to suffer. So, I mean, did they ever find out or perhaps look at a potential for that kind of response from someone?
Well, Paul, I will tell you this. This is a very long story, and I don't know if you've got the time, but I will tell you off of the book, this woman is still suffering from whatever has plagued her in the beginning of her life. She still lives today. As a matter of fact, I know where she lives, but of course she wants anonymity, so I will not disclose it. One of the things that her family has talked about, and this is after her spouse died, which is also in the book, his life was cut short when he was 20, 24 years old.
Yeah.
The whole family came together at one point. To discuss what has been happening, and the man's parents, the gentleman who passed away, his parents threw it up to, he was always depressed. He had been depressed since he was in secondary school.
Yeah.
And it was just a matter of time, and he just had an overactive imagination. So they were not open to the fact that there could have been something external to him, even though the woman knew that there was. And the tragedy of this is that she had actually seen the creature that he had seen at the window.
Yes.
And the audience is probably now baffled and wondering, without me actually talking about the contents of the book, leave it to say that he had seen a creature that was like a Mothman apparition. And it plagued him for months. It got to the point where he did not want to sleep because he felt that it was trying to take his soul. And I say that with no exaggeration whatsoever. I didn't get a chance to talk to him, obvious reasons. He had already passed away, and I was still a child at the time. So, but I did talk to his wife. I've talked to him, talked to her extensively, talked to her mother extensively, and a couple of other people who were neighbors that had witnessed some of the things that were going on in the house.
Yeah.
A lot of people felt that the house should be blessed, and that was done.
Yeah.
A lot of people went to the apartment, and the parish priest, you know, the local parish priest, was forbidden, expressly forbidden by the archdiocese to take the man's body and bury him on Christian ground. They did not want him interred or have a wake service for him inside a church because of what happened. So that was adding insult to injury. It was a very traumatic, needless to say, very traumatic on this woman, you know, who started having these experiences as a young child.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the direct connection from that kind of thing is obviously with his passing. Did the curse or the attention from whatever this creature is, did it make a conscious decision, do you think, to target the daughter, or was it just that they perhaps were, I don't know, open to that kind of attraction, if you know what I mean?
The culture itself is such that when things of this nature happened, and there is a suggestion that there is a family member who might have a mental illness, the reaction is to cover it up.
Yeah.
And so it was a source of confusion, but also a source of embarrassment.
Yeah, yeah.
They really didn't want the neighbors to know. And you know, the father was a prominent medical doctor.
Yes, of course.
You know, and the other gentleman, the man's father, was a banker. They did not want the names sullied. They didn't want the newspapers getting hold of what's going on. Even the neighborhood itself, they were very vague with what happened, even though some of the closer neighbors and friends knew what had actually happened. And eventually the whole talk died down. But here's the sad fact. Whatever it was that was in that apartment that he had seen coming out of the tree, and we're talking several months, several months, it followed the young woman and her infant child to her mother's house. And this is the same house that was already infested with all kinds of ghosts and apparitions. There was even a couple of UFO sightings in that house. And so, Paul, there's also that intersection between, you know, you've got people say the paranormal is separate from ETs, UFO sightings and things. I beg to differ. I really think that there is some kind of intersection between those two things. Almost like when people are talking, not to digress too far, but people talk about Bigfoot. And, you know, I had an incident in the book about a woman who claimed to have seen Bigfoot. I mean, she has no photographs and things of that nature. But people have talked about Bigfoot also seeing UFOs before or right after they've seen that creature. So, you know, when I speak of portal, I'm talking about anything that can come through from the alternate reality.
I mean, the term we use a lot in the UK is window areas, where it seems that a variety of phenomenon will appear at a similar juncture, very similar to what you're saying there. And that covers a variety of, you know, mystery, animal sightings, lights in the sky, an uptake in paranormal activity and hauntings in specific things, animal mutilations. Sometimes you will get, it doesn't happen a lot, quite often, that often, but there are specific areas where really strange thing that seems to tick every box, Adele, occurs in that specific area.
If I may interrupt, you remember Cannock Chase?
Yes.
Over where you are?
Yes, very much so.
I mean, what is it with the people dressed up as if they were in the 17th century?
Yeah.
Taking a stroll along with people from the current time, and they turn around and they're gone.
Yep.
And then the werewolves.
It's probably our most popular area. We haven't got many werewolf stories in England, but yeah, it's strange how Cannock Chase has got one of the better ones. Yeah.
So there you are. I mean, I think that there's definitely different levels of reality and different dimensions. And they're all kind of whispering at us, trying to remind us that it's not just this existence that is here. There are several levels of reality, all probably coexisting in the same space.
Yeah, very much. I think, as science has progressed and technology has advanced over the last, certainly it seems things seem to be moving at a far quicker pace than I can remember growing up. It seems that every other week there's a new discovery or something, some new theory seems to prove something else. And I think 20, 30 years ago, the potential of alternative dimensions and things like that were scoffed at out of hand by the scientific community. And I think now there's quite a growing base of people that share that belief that there has to be some kind of alternate dimension or reality, whether it's alongside Adele or around or in some particular aspect how it works, but there clearly has to be something else there.
And slowly people are starting to believe it. Slowly people who are, you know, what they call scientists maybe are talking about, you know, is it really linear physics when you look at reality?
Yep.
or is this really quantum physics? And someone had suggested, I forget his name now, he had suggested that the nature of reality can be explained by the principles of quantum physics.
Yeah.
Because we are in the three dimension, which is the lowest, well, not the lowest, I would say the animals probably, I mean, dogs can't see color.
Yep.
They're in the second dimension. But there's probably up to 20 day.
Yeah.
So when you consider that, and there's a lot of things that are beyond the range, not just of our vision or our hearing, but there's also all these other senses that we do not possess.
Yeah.
There was a mystic, and I'm trying to remember his name. I read up on him for a while and then lost track of him. He talked about the third eye and how the third eye in some people are open, and they would call them channelers or mediums. I don't know if you believe in that, Paul. Mm.
Yeah, well, it's a theory I've come across several times. My grandmother was a white witch.
That's wonderful. So she's got all these natural, organic cures.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely, yeah. I've been brought up with that kind of train of thought and theory, so I'm fully aware of the third eye principle, yes.
So when you think about that, only part of our brain is alive. The rest of it is still sleeping, so to speak. Mm. And more, I think you're seeing more and more people who are starting to tune in and awaken those parts of their brain that might not be receptive before is now more receptive. And I think you will see more and more people gravitating towards understanding things they were not receptive to understanding before. At least that's what I hope will happen.
Yeah.
You know, the world is short, as you can see.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting shorter all the time with the weather the way it is, and the animals becoming more and more extinct. Not to be in the gloomy,
that's okay.
You know.
That's okay, don't worry.
But, you know, the book certainly hints at alternate realities. And some parts of the book hint at actual people who are transported to a totally different reality. And what I've noticed with these accounts is some of them, they tell me there's always some kind of almost an imperceptible sound right before the encounter or the sighting.
Mm.
And it is like a distinct hum.
Mm.
They feel somehow that time slows down so that they can see better what they are witnessing, almost as if it is inviting them in to be able to see and fully experience. And some people have asked me, you know, you have my car plate, my license as UFO hunter from my days in MUFON.
Yeah.
And people say, how do you find them? And I said, I really don't find them. They find me. And it's the same, I think, with these bizarre and terrifying encounters, that, you know, with ghosts or whatever they are.
Mm.
They, if you are ready, they will find you.
Mm.
And even when you don't want to be found, somehow they reveal themselves. And I sincerely believe that none of these encounters are coincidental.
Mm.
I think they're intended for the person who's ready to be able to view them and maybe wake up.
Yep. I think that tends to, for me, it's one of those things that's always fascinated me is when someone has a particular type of experience, do they then go on to experience more because that initial experience jolts their reality, Adele, and basically maybe they suddenly start to look at things properly, if you know what I mean, whereas before they may have dismissed something out the corner of their eye or what they've heard. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know, Paul. A lot of the people I've talked to, you know, there's the family and friends that I met just last year, and they are very reluctant to rent an apartment or a house in France after that encounter. So I don't know that they're necessarily looking. I think they wonder, and their eyes are open in the sense that, okay, now I believe.
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
Been ghosts.
Yeah.
Now I believe, you know, that when I see something, it's not necessarily flesh and blood.
Yeah.
I don't know that they're looking for it, you know, like the woman who saw the Bigfoot across the street. And she moved.
Yeah.
She moved shortly after that. She, you know, she wanted to be safe. She didn't feel safe. She had lights put on in the front and in the backyard for her own safety. But after that, her sons come in and they said to her, you know, maybe this is not a good idea for you to be so isolated. So, I mean, some people, they become curious. I mean, I'm one of them, obviously.
Yep.
You know, I search for the accounts. I am not afraid to walk into a building. But, of course, you have to prepare. This is not a game. Once you're attached to them, it is a lifetime.
Yeah.
So it is not a game, and I have to tell the audience, you know, you think that it's exciting and it's mysterious and entertaining. There is nothing entertainment about an infested home, or there might be a malevolent spirit or a demon in there, and you walk out of there thinking, well, it's over, I'm gone, I've gotten in my car and drove away, and it doesn't matter how far you are. If it follows you, it follows you.
Very true.
So you have to be prepared. You have to be protected. You know, you have to have whatever faith you have. You have to go in there having an extremely deep conviction. And I don't want to wax religious, but it is the truth that you have to believe in a source or a creator. And you have to be very strong in that belief. Because if you waver and you have doubt and you walk into, you know, an area like Canop Chase, for example, and you are shaken and you don't know perhaps how to shield yourself or protect yourself beforehand, it will follow you.
There are, you know, several well-known investigators that have often, you know, given a breakdown of exactly that kind of attitude, because I think sometimes people can be quite laissez-faire about going in and, you know, oh, I've seen it, I've seen a few videos, I know what I'm doing. You know, with the greatest respect, you know, you're meddling with things that perhaps you don't fully understand and comprehend the consequences of.
Yes. And because they have more power than us, they can play with our minds. They can conjure events to our downfall. They can cause things to happen. These are creatures, or I would say entities, that have been here for centuries, much, much longer than we have. They can see things we can't see. And I've always, I've said this actually in another radio show, that the nature of the universe, I believe, is that it is steeped in duality.
Yeah.
And for everything positive, there is a negative counterpart. Simply because that's the way nature exists, and the way things are glued together. But it doesn't mean you have to endorse the negative, because that is the weaker force.
Absolutely.
So, but when people behave in such a fashion that they gravitate towards negative action, I think that invites those things, which are always around us. It's like an invitation for them to enter.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so.
But that's just my opinion.
No, that's fine. No, that's good. It's interesting. I mean, you know, I think everybody's entitled to to come across and explain, you know, that you have to take these things seriously, like you say. And I think, and especially when you're working in this particular field, regardless of whether it's, you know, you're looking into more paranormal events than more perhaps MUFON related incidents and experiences, I think regardless, you've still got to prepare yourself for whatever particular phenomenon you're potentially going to be coming up against.
Yes, I agree.
I mean, one of the great things, stories I liked in the book was the little story that mentions the chap that runs into the insectoid creature.
Oh, gosh.
Because
yes.
I remember many years ago reading a story about two men in America. I think they were in New Jersey and they were fishing. And one of them, I think they were separated. They couldn't see each other, but they were in shouting distance. So they were, you know, they were close. And he was fishing away and then something happened and he realised about 20 feet away from him was a 10-foot praying mantis. And I've always found that one of the most fascinating stories I've ever read. So when I saw your book and I read that one, I just thought, wow, that's eerily similar.
And it might be the same race of creatures.
Mm.
You might actually be, I mean, the intention of one, there's two stories in the book that deal with the insectoids. And this was during the period of time that I was with MUFON, and the other one was after. After I had already left the organization, people were approaching me because of an episode on the television.
Mm.
And this gentleman was very, very uncomfortable about being publicized, and I had to guarantee him. But, you know, here I was walking out of a liquor store.
Mm.
I had just purchased two bottles of wine, and it was your normal afternoon as we were going into, you know, a few hours before dinner time.
Yeah.
Dinner starts earlier over here. So, but this gentleman approached me and he said, "I remember you from the show." And I did a double take and he said, "Are you, you know, still investigating, because I've got a story if you've got the time." And here I am, I'm about my, you know, about to get into my car. And I said, "Sure." And I have a notebook in the car. I took the notebook out of the car. "Do you mind if I write this down?"
Mm.
I have about four notebooks with all these things. And so this was the notebook I was using for the for MUFON. And we ended up sitting in a little table, you know, right by the sidewalk, and he started telling me the story.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was something that it was his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And the young woman was terrified, had to go to a doctor. But the sad part about these witnesses is that they're very elusive.
Mm.
They will tell you the story, and then, you know, without a doubt, they experienced it.
Yeah.
Or at least in this case, the gentleman overheard her entire story and was terrified enough that he took her to the doctor.
Yeah.
But when it came down to, "Can you share the results with me?" You know, he told me exactly where it happened. So I tracked back.
Yeah.
I went back to the area of the encounter. Went there around the same time of the evening that she had it. But this was, of course, maybe 3 weeks later. And you know, Paul, you know, the trail grows cold with every passing day.
Yep.
So if there was something on the ground that was a mark, it's probably not going to be there. Cars have already driven over it over and over again.
Mm.
So I took some photographs and things, but there was really nothing unusual. I was hoping he would come back and show me the doctor's notes, the reports, and the photographs of what happened to her.
Yeah.
But, you know, just with other cases in the book, they're very elusive. First of all, they were already terrified to come forward, and then to even follow it further, they just shy away.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's something I've spoken to with several guests. I'm always of admiration for some people that take the chance to actually come to the public eye with a fantastical story, regardless of what realm of the paranormal it comes from, Adele. Because we all know what tends to happen to these people once the mainstream gets hold of them. They get absolutely destroyed.
Yes. And I would tell you, there was a story of a gentleman. This is not in my book, but this was on the episode, and so it's really public knowledge, but of course he doesn't want his real name disclosed. Mm. After that was aired, he expressly told me, since I was the key investigator in the case, he called me up and he said, it's continuing, but I don't want any press. Mm. I don't want you to notify the organization. I don't want you to come in because there's things on the ground. And these things, he said they were like, I don't know if you're familiar with them. It's a piece of candy. It's called Starlight Mints.
Mm.
And it's kind of like a white flat candy.
Yeah.
With a whirl of like pink, dark pink.
Yeah.
And it's usually a mint. You're familiar with it.
Yes, I've seen it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So weeks after this initial sighting, and this sighting was an actual saucer that was the size of a mall, and I'm not kidding you.
Mm.
It was the size of a mall, and it was octagonal in shape, and it had flags around it, and for some reason at 4 a.m. as he was standing by his bedroom window, he couldn't sleep. He was standing looking up at the cloud, and suddenly this thing clears it.
Mm.
And it makes a turn, a 90 degree turn, right over the field in front of him, right outside his window.
Yeah.
That was publicized and everything, and it made it to the TV, and they made all kinds of sketches and drawings and yada, yada, yada. But weeks later, he calls me, he says, this is just for you to know. It's still continuing, and now he's seeing Starlight Mints close to the ground in the backyard of his house. And this is like a 3-4 acre piece of ground, the property. And, you know, and I said, okay, we let it go at that. If it doesn't hurt you, you don't need any help. You don't need any explanations.
Mm.
I think you already know the nature of them.
Yeah.
But the question remains for most of them is, why me?
Yeah.
Why did it seek me out? What is it that I have that other people don't have?
Yeah, very true. Because I think there are notable cases in, as I'm sure you've come across in your time with MUFON, you know, things like Flatswood is a fantastical story that bears no kind of comparison to any other case, I think. And often when you speak to these people, the general feeling a lot of them have is, why me?
Yes.
Regardless of, you know, be it a haunting or a big... I mean, I remember once a few years ago, I saw an interview with a gentleman who was an avid hiker in British Columbia, and he'd had a Bigfoot sighting. And it's probably one of the most compelling interviews I've ever heard, because he was so close to... it was about 10 years after the incident, and it had completely changed his life. And he was, throughout that, I think it was about a 15-minute conversation, he was as close to tears without crying you could be, describing it, as I've ever seen someone be interviewed on television that wasn't talking about losing, you know, who wasn't grieving or had lost someone. He was completely changed by that experience, and it was still audible in the way he spoke about it, even though it was 10 years later.
Yes. Where the feelings are there, you know, and if it's something that happened recently, it is heartbreaking to hear it and not be able to do anything about it. There was a similar case like that where the woman had posted something on a Star Team website on MUFON, and I happened to be the dispatcher at the time, and my job was to read the report as it came in across the screen.
Hmm.
And actually contact the person that just filed the report within minutes. So within minutes, I called this woman, and this is included in the book.
Yep.
And you could feel from miles away her fear.
Yeah.
And you could feel the desperation in her voice. Why is this happening to me? I'm really terrified to live here.
Yeah.
And then she reported the results of her doctor visit a couple of weeks later, and I called her again. And it was the mandate of the person who was funding, who will go unnamed, that they wanted something that had to do with craft technology.
Yep.
And for us to focus on that. So this, among other cases, went uninvestigated.
Yeah.
And my question has always been, what are we doing for the abductees who have been traumatized?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, like Bud Hopkins has had, you know, in his time, he's run support groups and things of that nature.
Yep.
I think Whitley Strieble has been instrumental in doing some of that as well.
Very much so, yeah.
And David Jacobs, who is over here on my edge of the woods, you know, he's now an older gentleman. I believe he's already retired from the university. But for a time, he terrified people with his videotapes, his investigations. Yeah. They could not handle it. They could not wrap their head around the enormity of it.
Yeah, I think that's a situation that's sometimes overlooked in these cases, Adele, that people just expect these people to tell these stories or share their experience and don't understand the emotional impact that these situations have on these people. And it's often someone's gets dragged into the spotlight, everybody talks about them, calls them every name under the sun, and then when everybody goes on to the next story that they've picked up on, these poor people are still left dealing with the ramifications of whatever happened to them.
And they are ridiculed, they're terrified, and that's why they don't want to be named, they don't want their location disclosed. I mean, look, you know, over there you're going to have a conference with Calvin,
yes.
Calvin Parker.
Yes, I'm going to that.
You are? Okay, yes. So 45 years, Paul, it took him to finally come forward. And between all that time, he was dealing with all kinds of, you know, emotional, medical issues because of it. Because no one really, you know, people are not kind to people who have experiences of that nature.
Oh, very much so. I mean,
you know, and
yeah, go on. Sorry, Adele.
No, no, I was just going to say, sometimes they wait until they're retired.
Yeah, well, why not? I think you get to a certain age and you just think, what the hell? I don't care anymore.
And your employer is no longer there.
Yeah, exactly.
Your co-workers are no longer there to mock you.
Yep.
I remember the period of time when I was with MUFON, and it continues still. You know, they tried to put that on the news, all these sightings, because they had a we had a UFO flap back in 2008, you know, and the director for Pennsylvania said there was over 700% increase in sightings. They put it on the regular news, and the kind of press that they give, it's always laced with ridicule, and, you know, it's not very mature.
Yeah, well, usually I think the three things, and it happens all over the world, it's not just the States, it happens in the UK as well. They will usually use three things. They will either use the X-Files theme, which is the go-to theme for any spooky story that anybody puts on the news. They'll mention Little Green Men or tinfoil hats.
Oh, yes.
So I think it's the same all over. I've seen stories, I've seen news reports from Australia that are exactly the same. I mean, the Westall incident in Australia. Is one of those stories that I just don't understand why more people don't know about that, because it's one of those, it seems to be tucked away in ufology somewhere, and that's a really compelling case. But that, the same again, the witnesses got absolutely destroyed by the media, that, you know, everybody was mad.
And you've got a whole group of children.
Yep.
Plus the teachers that were involved, the entire building.
Mm-hmm.
And they throw it up as a mass hallucination.
Yeah.
You know, they were trying to clamor for attention. People who are respectable don't clamor for attention. And you know, I just don't know what to say. Absolutely. But my book, I hope, is something that is eye-opening, and I, you know, I just want people to read it with an open mind.
Yeah.
I'm not aiming for anything in particular except for them to start thinking about what is really out there, and that just because you can't see it or hear it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, because then it will knock on your door to remind you that it is.
Yeah, I think some people deserve a knock, to be fair, Adele.
Yes, and you know, sometimes people toss it up no matter what.
Yeah.
You know, I think it has to do with how many people do you know around you. If you're the only one, you wonder, maybe you were just feeling tired. They toss it up to different things.
Mm.
But it's kind of hard to dismiss it if it keeps happening. And I think with this family, maybe there was an element of refusal.
Yeah.
Maybe they were dismissing it, and then eventually it just came, it kept coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And the experiences started to become a little different.
Yep.
That was the same family where they had a huge UFO on the top of the house, above the roof. So, you know, I don't know why. I don't know why they in particular. I couldn't answer that question for you.
I mean, the other aspect of this as well is, you know, as we've touched on, is a lot of shame that can be associated with this kind of these witnesses, because, like you say, it's putting yourself out there for ridicule, but then it also makes their close friends and family question their sanity, and depending on your, you know, the cultural background or wherever you are in the world, different places view these kind of experiences very differently.
Yes, and I'll tell you, after these different incidents in that particular home, because it's a Roman Catholic nation,
mm-hmm.
They've had that parish priest coming over there, you know, they were on first name basis.
Yep.
It got to that point where the poor man was coming in and out of the house, and you know, exorcisms are unheard of during that time. I don't even know what that man would do to get a hold of the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
But he would come in, he had his baton, and I tell you, it kept happening because there was another event. Early in the 70s, and I don't know if we're running out of time here for this last story.
Oh, you're all right, don't worry.
I'm okay.
As long as you're all right, I'm all right.
Okay. This was during the Marcos regime. You probably remember Imelda with her 2,000 shoes.
Yes.
Okay. Their period of reign, as I would call it, was, I would say, 10 years. The normal presidency, from what I understand, and presidency here in the U.S. is about 4 years. In the Philippines, it's 5.
Yeah.
It is unbelievable that this man was actually voted again, and they manipulated that, I think. And in his second reign, he declared martial law.
Yeah.
The country was extremely prosperous, and I don't mean to go into politics, but mm-hmm. for the purposes of the story, I will.
Yep.
The country was very prosperous. At the time, it was much more prosperous than Japan, if you can believe it.
Yep.
It was rising, it was doing commerce with Europe,
yep.
Which is not even a neighbor, it's on a totally separate area of the globe, but it was getting goods back and forth
mm-hmm.
from the major European countries. You remember Pick Freen's cookies?
Yes.
Yes, we referred to them as biscuits. And we had our tea,
yep.
and we had our coffee and cocoa from Spain.
Mm-hmm.
At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, okay, courtesy of the Spanish and the British, they were flocking in, all kinds of chocolates, you name it, we had it.
Yeah, we were definitely getting British influence if you're using the word biscuits.
Called them biscuits, we still do. You know, and then the Italians had their biscotti, and my grandmother used to say, yeah, that's the same thing, biscotti, biscuit. It's just that it's tougher and you have to dunk it. Okay. But it was a tremendous exchange of commerce.
Mm.
And it was wonderful. Cars were coming in of all makes and models. To make a long story short, it was in its heyday one of the best countries in Asia. Yeah. Until Mr. Marcos and his wife with the 2,000 shoes came in. And they had martial law.
Yeah.
That brought in almost like a civil war.
Yeah.
Okay, and they had guerrillas running to the mountains. My mother, who was a journalist at the time, went underground.
Yeah.
There was a lot of mayhem in the streets. There was a curfew.
Yep.
And when you were caught, you were imprisoned. Mm. Okay? But that was not all, Paul.
Yeah.
The people who were caught in the streets were sometimes shot. And one afternoon, as I was coming home to this neighborhood, the school bus that normally would drive down the street and drop you off right at your gate, mm. dropped me off at the edge of the neighborhood. Mm. And as it went on, apparently there was some kind of problem happening in the street. And along the wall of this haunted house, and the wall is made of stone,
yep.
which went to about 7 feet high, there were people lined up with their backs to the wall, with their hands clasped behind their head. Mm. And in front of them was this huge, I guess it must have been a Hummer.
Yep.
There was a gentleman up the top with a machine gun, clad in fatigues.
Yeah.
And there was another man next to him holding a rifle. And as I was walking down the street, they opened fire.
Unbelievable.
And I saw 8 men just drop one right after the other to the ground. There was an open canal in front of them, you know, for irrigation.
Yep.
And the first thing I remember, and the thing I still remember to this day, is the smell of ripe grapes.
Yeah.
And gunpowder.
Yeah.
And that will always remain in my head. Mm. How they just kind of dropped like yeah. mannequins.
Yeah.
So months and months later, neighbors started talking about avoiding walking in the evening on this street. And families would say they kept their children indoors. This is a beautiful neighborhood, Paul.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful neighborhood, very peaceful,
mm.
you know, except for the hauntings inside the homes.
Yeah.
The street was okay.
Yeah.
Until this time, they started seeing these men standing there against the wall that would simultaneously disappear, mm. and then you would hear the screaming.
Right. Oh, good me. I mean, that's really interesting as well, for because that's quite an unusual type of haunting, really, because it's not very often, because you know, sometimes you will see things, you know, in a haunted house, things moving about, there'll be wailing, certain strange noises, whatever. But it's reenactments of an actual incident being replayed.
Yes.
And not, you know, there are very few occurrences, and most of them, in my opinion, I think, you know, from the top of my head and what I've read and heard about and seen, they tend to be usually acts of war or something military. And you know, we've got lots in the UK of civil war reenactments, or as I refer to, Glencoe was another battle that was during the English trying to, you know, completely take over Scotland. So that's very similar in that kind of way, that perhaps it's such an emotionally compelling moment that's why it came back, that's why it was a reoccurring vision, as it were.
Yes. And I think for the part of the people who were there, they probably never even thought that their day would end that way. and they probably are rehashing in their head emotionally.
Mm.
I could have been somewhere else.
Yep.
And I'm trying to accept that I'm gone, that I passed on to the other side because of this, just because I was at the wrong place,
yes,
at the wrong time, past curfew.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think we should never underplay the brutality of the Marcos regime, and I think it deserves not to be forgotten, not for any other reason, but just to remind ourselves of the cruelty of humanity at times.
So there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, yeah, I mean, that's a terrifying story, really. I mean, is it still seen in the area?
You know, I have not asked because everybody that is now in the neighborhood,
they don't know.
As far as I'm aware, they have moved on. I know the family on the one side of me,
yeah,
have moved to Australia.
Mm.
The people, and I almost said their name,
so,
who had a they had a chauffeur, they had a whole complement of servants.
Mm.
They have moved overseas. Actually, I think they're in the UK.
Ah.
So there's quite a number that have already moved on to jobs overseas.
Yeah.
And the ones that have remained, I believe, are just the, you know, like distant relatives or maybe even the elderly.
Yeah.
So I've lost touch with them. I have kept in touch with two key people that are in the book, simply because they happen to have moved on the eastern seaboard of the U.S., and which is how I got this book together. There are relatives that live in the southern part of Luzon, which is the largest island. And they used to live around that neighborhood. Some of the stories came from them,
mm-hmm,
firsthand accounts, and then the stories of the current neighborhood that they're in, that is also haunted. And I forget who it was, but there was a previous show where I was asked, is this unusual for an Asian country? And I would say no.
Mm.
It's just that it happened to be the place where I was born and raised. So I'm obviously more familiar with the people and the culture.
Yep.
And I happen to be in the same neighborhood. But I would say that any country that has experienced tragedy, which would be everybody, would have these things lingering. And, you know, in the dead of night, you would see things that you don't expect.
I think that is something that you can kind of go around the world and there will be certain cases in certain areas that are very, very similar, I think, in most countries.
Well, I would tell you this, Paul, and I've never told anybody else about this until now. I'm planning on going to France again. I've been to France about four times.
Mm-hmm.
For a fifth time, I'm going back to France next summer. Actually, this summer as well, but next summer will be a protracted one. I will be there for a couple of months.
Right.
And I am aiming for the Dordogne area, which is a central portion of France.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some of its history. You probably do as well. That was the demarcation line between the British and the French.
Yep.
And there was a war and battles that happened in the area. So I'm wondering, you know, I'm looking for a character house to live in.
Mm.
You know, to rent.
Yeah.
And you never know. You never know what you're going to see.
Oh, very good. That'd be nice. That'd be probably like homework, I would imagine, Adele, if you've got somebody living in the house with you. It probably makes it the easiest investigation ever.
Yeah, and it's interesting because when I travel, I always aim to get to connect with the locals. You know, when I've done some touring earlier in my salad days where I was actually in a tour group. And, you know, that's very different when you're sitting on a bus with 24 other people,
yep,
that have never seen a country. You're staring at buildings most of the time.
Yeah.
And you're eating tourist fare. You're not really eating what they're making.
Yes.
You're eating whatever. Oh, here's the regional specialty by a 4-star restaurant.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you walk into a place that's really just near the bus depot, and then you encounter an actual pub.
Yeah.
You know, or you encounter a little village, and there's a real restaurant there, so to speak, that the locals go to.
Mm.
But you're not going into their homes. You're not really going to the grocery store. You don't get a flavor of the life and the actual culture that is beneath it. You're hearing more of the history and looking at the building. But when you're there and you're actually there living there on a daily basis for a few months, you know, it could be 2 months, could be 6 months, you really get a feel and the vibe of the people.
Mm.
And that's what I always aim for. And as you probably already guess, I tend to, and unwittingly, without meaning to, and people say this to me all the time, you know, I'm talking to an Indian woman on the street, I'm starting to talk Indian, you know, or Indian accent in English. I talk to British people, I start talking with a British accent. That is not intentional.
I'm going to say you don't want to be picking up my Yorkshire accent, Adele. That could be really confusing for everyone.
I understand you fine. I really do.
Good.
And I think that you have to go in with both feet and both hands and immerse yourself. And when that happens, people are more receptive to telling their stories.
Yeah.
And that's how I was able to harvest some of the stories from the foreign countries, from countries in different areas, because people, you know, will talk.
Mm.
They will talk about their current experiences, and then they'll talk about what happened to them on the previous trip.
Yeah.
Or in a neighborhood that they used to live in.
Yeah.
And I guarantee their anonymity. As a matter of fact, if I am to write a second book, I will tell the audience this, that if you do have a story that is singular, that is unexplainable and uncanny, I welcome it. I will guarantee your anonymity. I will not disclose your actual location unless you want me to.
Mm-hmm.
And they can always email me the story. I can also be found on Facebook under my pen name, Adele Casals Rocha. And they can also follow me on Twitter, I believe. For some reason, Twitter is using my real name. I'm not really that well versed on the technology, but I'm also on Instagram.
Brilliant. Well, no, it all sounds really good. And listen, just before I let you go, I can't let you go because, strangely enough, you've just mentioned France there.
Okay.
And my favourite story in your book is the one about the bipedal deer.
Oh, gosh.
So yeah. shall we finish with this one?
Okay. Do you want me to tell you the story?
Yeah, you can do if you
yes.
like.
Yes. Okay. So in one of the times when I was actually within a tour group, there was a couple that befriended us. They were from the UK. And they actually rented a beautiful farmhouse in France. And I will not disclose the actual area for good reason. I don't want tourists veering away from it. They incidentally ended up in a rather remote location. So they were the only farmhouse for miles, and it's a good thing they had a car. They hired a car, and they had gone to dinner, and upon coming back, noticed as they were approaching they call it a gîte, French for rental. As they were approaching the farmhouse, at the periphery of their vision, they saw the barn door was open. And within the barn was a light. It was a blue light. They thought perhaps maybe the landlord had stopped by to check in. You know, as they are to do if they're local. And in this case, the gentleman was, you know, somewhere within the area. They were looking, but they did not want to really look within the barn. There was a sense of apprehension.
Yeah.
And since, because it was a lonely and remote, isolated farmhouse, they figured they'd best go in. So they parked, and he went in, and she was looking and went in, and they locked the door, and they went to bed. It was late. You know, dinner in France is also late. It's probably about 8 or 9 p.m., and, you know, it's a whole affair.
Yes,
you just don't eat 20 minutes or 30 minutes like they do in the States. They actually eat and spend time talking.
Yeah.
So this was in the wee hours. By the time they got home, and they were in the bedroom, and she happened to look out the window, and, you know, there was no air conditioning, as a usual European home does not have air conditioning, not like a spoiled Americans here.
Well, we don't we don't get the weather to have air conditioning, to be fair, Adele.
Exactly. And so the window was open to the breeze, and she was looking, and she thought, okay, the light is still on. Do you think maybe the landlord is there? So he calls the landlord. Okay, and I forget the nature of the call, but it was such that he realized it was not him. So as she was looking out the window, she noted deer approaching the house. And he walked over, and he was leaning out the window, and she pulled him in because she sensed that there was something very anomalous about them. And they were standing on their hind legs. The deer were standing on their hind legs. Which, you know, deer do not do.
When I read that, I was just like, what on earth? I mean, you wouldn't want to see that outside your own home. Never mind 1,000 miles away from where you live. It's not my idea of a relaxing break at all.
No. They were so terrified that shortly they did notify the landlord, and he said, you know, I've never seen anything here. I've never had ghosts and yada, yada, yada. And they broke the lease. They told them, we are going to move into the next village so that we can walk to everything.
That's the thing that kind of made me think, well, clearly something went on, because with the greatest respect, firstly, it's not the type of story you would tell someone, or anywhere would it be possibly considered a reasonable excuse for breaking a lease.
Yes. And this is a well-traveled couple. I mean, this was a trip, I'm trying to think of whether it was the Eastern Europe trip that we were on. And they explained that they've been through several different countries, and they wanted to kind of take a break and do something different. And we've done the same, my husband and I, where, you know, we say, okay, we're done with waking up at 5 a.m., putting the luggage out at 6 a.m., eating breakfast in a hurry, you know, and you know, when they have breakfast on these tours, Paul, you know, you will drool. There's so many things. It's a buffet, and you end up weighing 20 pounds, and then you're stumbling behind the tour guide who's holding up some kind of relic as they're stumbling through the streets, and everybody's looking at you like, what's the big rush? So we have taken these type of breaks, what we just read, which is what we're doing when we go to France again, and you never know what you're going to encounter, like the one with the Morocco story, which I will save for some other time. But
definitely, I could talk to you all night. But yes, because I'll not spoil it. But yeah, I was going to mention that one. That was my backup to the deer story. So I really like that one as well.
Yeah.
So listen, thank you again for your time today. Where can everybody find you again? So can you just reconfirm where people can track you down and follow you and see what you're up to?
Yes, I am on Facebook under my name, Adele Casals Rocha. Once in a while, I am on Instagram under the same name, and that's really because I use that as a site to upload photographs that I've taken. I'm an amateur travel photographer. So when I do have new photographs that I have taken of a certain country, I usually upload it on Instagram. I am also on Twitter. And as I mentioned before, it's actually under my two dogs. I have three dogs, but two of them are on it. Fox and Rosanna, N as in Nancy, Rosanna, R-O-S-A-N-N-A. If you have a story that you would love to share with me for my next book, I would gladly take it. If it is considered, I will mail you a signed copy of my book. And that email address that you could email the story to, and feel free to attach pictures. Okay, I will not use your name unless you really want me to use your name. Mm-hmm. Is Cine Gravitas. That's C as in cat, I-N-E, Gravitas, G-R-A-V-I-T-A-S, at yahoo.com. I, incidentally, I'm also a screenwriter. So hoping to have a movie produced someday. So that is the portal that is probably the best way to reach me. Cinegravitas at yahoo.com.
Brilliant. And obviously the book is available on Amazon, and it's a fabulous book.
The book is called Portal, A Lifetime of Paranormal Experiences. It is on Amazon, Kindle, and as well as hardback, paperback.
Fabulous, and a great book it is. I recommend it highly. It's a really, really good read. Lots of great stories of really tantalising investigations and experiences, Adele.
Thank you.
I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you today, so thank you so much for your time. And best of luck with the book.
You.
I hope it continues to sell this the remainder of the year. And good luck with the second volume, and we will speak again, I hope.
Thank you, Paul. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. You take care.
Bye-bye.